Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Carbon Queen, The Remarkable Life of Nanoscience Pioneer Mildred Dresselhaus, by Maya Weinstock, narrated by Eva Wilhelm. When raising kids was women's work, when homemaking was an aspiration, she debunked tradition, swept others up in her contrails, flew in the face of inequality, donned the epaulettes of a doctorate, destabilizing the norms in academic male humdrum, in the atom-splitting world of science. Her brilliance spawned theories and theorems, unlocked the secrets of carbon's electronic structure, the mysterious forms it takes in nature, predicting the existence of carbon nanotubes, those single-atom-thick cylinders of carbon for use in stronger materials, ultra-strong cables, hydrogen storage, advanced electronics, solar cells, batteries. Working alongside her husband, who never left her in his considerable shadow, she gave birth to 4 children and pioneering work on vibrational mechanical energy. And now, well into her 80s, with myriad awards added to the epaulettes, when the trail for women has been long blazed, I wonder whether she realizes that her footprint matches one of the first on the path. Carolyn Vandermeer, The Queen of Carbon, 2016. Prologue. Miss Sophia Harvey, 7 going on 8, stands before her dining room table, transfixed by a powder blue bag. She is surrounded by a coterie of family and friends who have gathered to celebrate her 8 years with cupcakes, presents, and games. The gift bag seems just the right size, and Sophia can barely contain her excitement at the possibility that someone may have gotten her the one thing she's been wishing for all year. Like a grizzly fishing for salmon, Sophia plunges her hand into the bag, grasps firmly at the object within, and yanks out a navy cardboard box. Inside, a Barbie-style action figure in the likeness of an octogenarian woman, gray hair pinned up in braids, stares back at her. "A Millie Dresselhaus doll!" Sophia gasps. "This is the best birthday ever!" On a soundstage in New Delhi, Sunita Rajavat makes final preparations for her guest, a personal hero she has anticipated interviewing for months. Thanks to a stroke of magic, the producers of her show, one of the most popular in India, have managed to book the interview on Millie Dresselhaus Day, hashtag Millie Day on social media, an unofficial holiday celebrated annually on November 11th, the eminent scholar's birthday. After a brief meeting offstage, the time has come to introduce her guest to the studio audience and to the millions of viewers watching remotely. As the audience provides a standing ovation, Sunita feels her pulse rise. She takes Millie's hand, welcomes her to the stage, and proclaims enthusiastically, "We are so glad to have you here." It's midday in Toronto, and Millie Dresselhaus is enjoying a leisurely lunch with longtime colleague Olivier Réaume at their favorite seafood joint. On this brilliant afternoon, she and Olivier sip cool drinks and talk nanotubes over Faroese herring and locally caught trout. The paparazzi are out in force, snapping away as Millie nibbles on her fish. She manages to lose them after the meal, when the restaurateurs allow her to slip out the back. But later that afternoon, a pair of young men run her down on the sidewalk. "Une photo avec vous?" they ask breathlessly. She agrees, and one of the men snaps a selfie. After thanking her profusely and wishing her a pleasant stay in Canada, he posts the memento to Instagram with the inscription, "Regardez qui est? Millie! Hashtag Millie! Hashtag Reine de Carbone!" By nightfall, the post has over 722,000 likes and counting. The preceding fictional vignettes, starring the real-life scientist and engineer Mildred Millie Dresselhaus, were presented in a 2017 advertisement from General Electric as a vision of what the world might be like if prominent women in science were treated as A-list celebrities. I've added names and story details to the vignettes to help bring the video to life. The spot was meant to at once celebrate one of the most accomplished researchers of our time, inspire the next generation of women in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and inform the public about the company's plans to hire more women in technical roles. In addition to being the model for a doll and a target of paparazzi, Millie became the namesake of numerous newborns, the most popular dress-up costume at Halloween, and an icon whose image was plastered on cityscapes, T-shirts, and teenagers' text messages. The video was a resounding success and in real life went viral on social media. Yet this brief star turn for Millie Dresselhaus barely skimmed the surface of what she accomplished in her remarkable 86 years. Millie's research forever altered our understanding of matter, the physical stuff of the universe that has mass and takes up space. A longtime professor of electrical engineering and physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Millie also played a significant role in inspiring people to use this new knowledge to solve some of the world's greatest challenges, from producing clean energy to curing cancer. As her nickname suggests, the Queen of Carbon is most often heralded for her pioneering work with one of the world's most abundant and versatile substances. Most of us know carbon as the smooth, slippery graphite of a pencil tip, the alluring shimmer of a diamond ring, and the Jekyll and Hyde of energy, both the basis of hydrocarbons that we transform into electricity and petroleum-based commodities, as well as the byproduct of fossil fuel combustion that's warming Earth's atmosphere at an alarming rate. Carbon is also the stuff of life, the element that makes compounds organic and one of the few elements present in all of the living organisms we know about. Scientists say there are about 10 million carbon compounds, with more being discovered each day. As a result of Millie Dresselhaus's insatiable curiosity about our world and her nearly six-decade career as a scientific explorer, we can thank her for significant leaps in how we think about carbon's various forms and the company it keeps. In her early career, Millie employed a recent invention, laser light, to probe carbon's inner workings, to distinguish how, for example, flat layers of carbon atoms act differently from carbon crystals of three dimensions, especially in the presence of heat, electrons, or a magnetic field. And she predicted the existence of what we now call carbon nanotubes, sheets of carbon atoms rolled up into minuscule cylinders that can be remarkably adept at conducting electricity. Based on Millie's far-reaching foundational research, scientists and engineers have made enormous advances at the nanoscale, with structures on the order of 1/100,000th the width of a human hair. Spherical carbon buckyballs, cylindrical carbon nanotubes, and two-dimensional carbon sheets known as graphene have been developed for use in energy storage, medical research, building materials, and paper-thin electronics, among many other applications. In the past 10 years alone, the pace of discovery has skyrocketed. These carbon structures continue to be developed for myriad novel uses, with quite a few seemingly out of the realm of science fiction, from ultra-fast quantum computers to efficient desalination devices to electronics-infused bodily organs. In an era in which, for the first time in history, a significant portion of all human knowledge can be called up Star Trek-like at any time from a tiny screen on your wrist, it may seem difficult to imagine that computer science hadn't even come into its own as an academic discipline when Millie Dresselhaus began her career in 1958. It was only 4 years earlier, in 1954, that silicon was first used to fabricate transistors, semiconducting devices that allow the controlled flow of electrons and came to serve as the basis for modern computing machines. Today's engineers are just beginning to exploit the electronic properties of carbon in a wave of technological progress that may one day lead to the development of a carbon corridor to match Silicon Valley. And while numerous scientists and engineers have helped pave the way toward a future of carbon-based technologies, Millie Dresselhaus pioneered both theories and experiments that led to a fundamental shift in what we know about the electronic structure of carbon and the fascinating things that happen when researchers stir bits of other elements into carbon samples. Nanoscientists in particular owe a massive debt to work that Millie Dresselhaus carried out during her multifaceted career. At its simplest, you can think of nanoscience as the study of material structures between 1 and 100 nanometers in size. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter. As a whole, nanoscience is an extraordinarily diverse line of inquiry, with major contributions from disciplines as varied as biology, chemistry, computer science, electrical engineering, materials science and engineering, mechanical engineering, and physics. The field has helped to uncover the secrets behind a host of materials, but carbon is inarguably one of the most intriguing from the perspective of potential nanoscale applications. As a result, it's safe to say the Queen of Carbon played an outsized role as a founding pioneer of nanoscience and consequent nanotechnologies, all of which continue to grow in leaps and bounds. In all, Millie authored or co-authored an astounding 1,700 research articles and 8 books, largely relating to carbon and its fundamental properties. She spoke the languages of science and engineering as if they were her mother tongue. But she was far more than a brilliant researcher. She was also a tireless educator and role model for both the young people she worked with and for those near and far who aimed to follow in her footsteps. Her mentorship activities evolved as she transitioned from young professor, one of the first women on the MIT faculty, to internationally recognized advocate for science and engineering. But throughout her career, she was a beloved figure, providing countless individuals with support at every stage along their journeys in academia or elsewhere. Millie didn't just create a lab. She created a family. She worked with us to ensure we succeeded, wrote Sandra Brown, former student and now associate general counsel at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, in a 2017 tribute. She was also a truly genuine and sincere person. One of the proudest days of my life was when Millie met my parents, blue-collar workers and first-generation immigrants from a developing country. Millie shook their hands with the kind of warmth she's shown to presidents, princes, and dignitaries. She had a way of making you feel like you mattered, regardless of your status or start. Beyond her mentorship and advocacy, Millie was also a trailblazer whom countless women in science and engineering looked up to. She was the first female MIT Institute professor, the highest distinction for faculty at MIT. She was the first woman to win a National Medal of Science in the category of engineering. And she was the first solo recipient of the prestigious Kavli Prize, given biennially in the disciplines of astrophysics, nanoscience, and neuroscience. To be sure, such firsts are often little more than reflections of the awarding institutions. But firsts beget notability, and notability begets influence. And when your line of work continues to suffer from significant underrepresentation of certain groups, being a first can have considerable tangible effects by inspiring, for example, individuals who might not otherwise consider venturing into engineering or physics or mathematics, or who might simply need a little support. Millie knew this and used her influence as a pioneer whenever she could. She did so as a leader of numerous national societies representing scientists and engineers around the United States. She did so for innumerable international colleagues. And she did so at her home institution of MIT, often quietly and without fanfare. From her earliest years in Depression-era New York City, Millie embodied resilience. She could have made a fortune in lemonade, given how she handled the many lemons that came hurtling toward her and her family. fending off challenging environments as well as active discouragement from certain educators and advisors in her youth and early adulthood, she never let anyone derail her curiosity, and she made every effort to pay it forward for others. While she may not have been a media celebrity with a massive global following, as in the ad that celebrated her life, Millie was nothing less than a hero to many in her home country and around the world. The story of her life, which began in immense poverty, involved a childhood battle against a deadly disease, and required persistence through low expectations and sexist attitudes to become a highly influential and revered scientist, provides insights into the workings of an ever-expanding mind, the ongoing evolution of societal attitudes toward women and people of color in science and engineering, and the unique power of kindness. 1. Diamond in the Rough. In the shadow of the Brooklyn Bridge, where the storied span meets the bustling Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, a quiet, unassuming stub of Sands Street hides its secrets well. For half a century, this once thriving thoroughfare was punctuated on its western end by a massive transit hub that connected Brooklyn to the rest of New York City and pulsed as the nerve center of the borough's sprawling elevated rail system. The three-story terminal also served as a gateway to the nearby Brooklyn Navy Yard, the can-do shipyard that produced warships in the 19th and 20th centuries, from the USS Ohio to the USS Constellation, CV-64, employing some 70,000 men and women during its heyday in the 1940s. Today, the byway connecting these two landmarks, some 10 minutes by foot, still exists at the nexus between several Brooklyn neighborhoods. But any semblance of its more colorful, pedestrian-friendly past, of shops, bars, or the transient Navy personnel it served, is long gone. In place of the former Sands Street Rapid Transit Station, which closed in 1944 and was later demolished, a series of access ramps now cuts through the western end of the street, allowing some 10,000 pedestrians and cyclists and over 60,000 motor vehicles to climb toward the bridge and across the East River into Manhattan every day. It is here, at 45 Sands, across from what is now a parking lot, that Mildred Millie Dresselhaus, one of the most influential scientists in modern history, began her remarkable life. Shortly after her birth in Brooklyn's Flatbush neighborhood, Millie's immigrant parents, Mayer and Ethel Spivak, moved here as the new owners of a newsstand and candy shop. Mere steps from the looming Sands Street terminal, which would inhale Brooklyn's working class during the morning rush and spit them back out after 8, 10, and 12-hour shifts, the shop offered magazines, fresh fruit, and bottles of chilled Coca-Cola, among other refreshments. It was a meager living, to be sure, but one that afforded Mayer and Ethel some stability and a means to pay their $25 a month rent. Millie's parents had come to America to escape an increasingly unstable Europe in the years after World War I. Her father, Mayer Spivak, hailed from the Polish village of Jewuszice, where the family trade had been singing. His father, brother, and grandfather had all been synagogue cantors. Spivak means singer in Polish. Millie's mother, Ethel Teichtheil, was originally from Galicia, a former Austro-Hungarian region that today encompasses parts of southeastern Poland and western Ukraine. Ethel's mother had died suddenly when Ethel was a child, and after the outbreak of World War I, her father moved the family to Holland for safety. There, Ethel became well-educated for a girl at the time. She had at least 8 years of formal schooling and excelled in languages. Like his granddaughter would be, Ethel's father was an expert in carbon, namely, diamonds, in which he traded. The Spivak family also worked in the diamond business, and Millie's parents met and became a couple as their families worked closely together. But as tensions between nations grew even deeper in Europe following the end of World War I, Ethel and Mayer became anxious about their future. After considerable deliberation, they decided they would be better off in America and made plans to begin new lives on the other side of the Atlantic. Mayer arrived in New York in 1921, and the couple married 2 days after Ethel joined him, on December 13, 1926. It was a prescient move. As Millie would recount in later years, nearly everyone in the Spivak and Teichtal families who stayed in Europe perished at the hands of the Nazis during the Holocaust. Though guaranteed certain basic freedoms in the United States, the transition to life in New York City was not an easy one for the Spivak family, which grew in 1928 with the birth of Millie's older brother Irving, and again on November 11, 1930, Armistice Day, now Veterans Day, when baby Mildred made the family 4. The Sand Street area they moved to, which today includes sections of Brooklyn Heights, downtown Brooklyn, Dumbo, and the Navy Yard, was rough. In his biography of the infamous gangster Al Capone, who, as a child, lived south of the Navy Yard's main entrance at Sand Street's eastern end, author Robert J. Schoenberg wrote, "Sands offered all the diversions suggested by the phrase drunken sailors. In uniforms customized at Max Cohn's, sailors could swagger into the saloons that lined Sands, then stagger out to the attendant pickup dance halls, brothels, hotbed rooming houses, pawn shops, and tattoo parlors." Indeed, Millie would later relay to her own children a story for the ages of the night when she was quite small, no more than about 3 years old, when a drunken sailor broke into her family's apartment, making a rowdy, fearsome scene and scaring everyone witless. This part of Brooklyn, it turned out, was also home to dangerous gangs, and the Sands Street station, with few police present, was often teeming with thieves. Making matters eminently worse was the economic black cloud that came storming through the United States a year before Millie was born. Lasting through the 1930s, the Great Depression colored much of Millie's childhood and early life, in Brooklyn, and especially so in the Bronx, where Millie spent her formative years. It would, among other things, make holding a job difficult for her father and force her mother to work long hours to put food on the table. It also compelled Millie to work odd jobs, some of which skirted child labor laws, on top of her schoolwork to help the family make ends meet. And yet a powerful calling would soon creep into Millie's world, one that would forever alter her trajectory. It was a pursuit that, as a young girl with limited resources, enabled her to see what in the world was possible. As an adult, it helped her to develop a repertoire with some of the most accomplished academics in the world, both when she was making her way and when she eventually became a highly regarded scholar and mentor herself. Throughout her life, this calling filled Millie's home and her spirit, providing her with a distinctive language with which to communicate, one she mastered even before learning to read. The calling was music, and thanks to Millie's older brother, it became her primary avocation for the rest of her long and storied life. Brooklyn to the Bronx. For young Irving Spivak, playing the violin was like breathing. Making his tiny instrument sing required no determined action or thought. He moved his fingers, and the notes just came. His talent was not an overwhelming surprise to his family, as generations of Spivak men before him had been skilled musicians. But by the time he was in preschool, Irv's prowess on the violin made others take notice. When one violin teacher in particular, one of the finest in New York City, met 5-year-old Irving, he felt strongly that the child had the makings of a prodigy and requested taking him on as a scholarship student. Irving's parents, eager for their son to take advantage of every opportunity for success, especially if it meant developing a musical talent, agreed to the arrangement. Being a scholarship student, Irv would apprentice with his teacher, lessons completely gratis, several times a week. The only glitch was that Irving's teacher was based in the Bronx at the Bronx House Music School, a daunting commute from Sand Street in Brooklyn. Irv and Millie's parents came up with a plan. If they sold their bodega and moved to the Bronx, Irv would be much closer to his teacher, and they wouldn't have to spend so much time transporting him to lessons. It was a calculated risk. It would cost the Spivaks just about all of their resources to relocate, and Mayer would need to find a new job to support the family. In their minds, however, the gamble was worth it. Music was part of the family's blood, and Irving's promise seemed legitimate. They buckled down and rolled the dice. As was often the case for American immigrants settling in New York in the early 1930s, things did not quite turn out as planned. Just months after the Spivaks gave up all they had to move into a meager tenement apartment in the Bronx, Irving's violin teacher died suddenly. The loss was an enormous blow, and it set off a chain of events that would keep the family in poverty for quite some time. And yet, as with several other pivotal moments in Millie's life, the setback came with silver linings that would reveal themselves in time, leading ultimately to key opportunities for both Irving and his kid sister. Having depleted their assets in relocating to the South Bronx, at that time a poor community with a large population of Central and Eastern European immigrants, the family had no means to pay for a new violin teacher. The United States was already deep into the Depression, with newspaper headlines reading like SOS alerts from doomed vessels. Industrial depression, unemployment, destitution! Idleness and want drive men to crime and suicide! Desperate situation demands serious consideration! Meanwhile, Mayor Spivak, who had become a day laborer after giving up the candy shop, was having trouble finding steady work to provide for his wife and children. Despite the meager assistance they received in the form of government-sponsored welfare, following Irving's talent was something the Spivaks felt they had to do. If nothing else, his gift might prove to be a source of much-needed cash in the not-too-distant future. Another teacher had to be found who would take him on pro bono. Thanks to Irving's tremendous abilities, a replacement was identified in short order, but the individual was once again a long commute away, this time at the Greenwich House Music School on the opposite side of the city in downtown Manhattan, exactly the kind of situation Mayer and Ethel had hoped to avoid by moving to the Bronx. Bound to accept a teacher who would offer services free of charge, there was little choice in the matter. The family had pinned its future on Irving's star and they couldn't move again, so the apprenticeship was arranged. It was around this time that young Millie Spivak began showing musical promise of her own. It wasn't the violin that impressed the adults around her, that would come later. Rather, Millie had developed a gift for musical memory. As a 4-year-old tag-along at her brother's lessons, she demonstrated that she could remember the melodies of many compositions and sing them flawlessly. This seemed to the teachers at Irving's music school to be the sign of another prodigy in the making. And so, Mildred joined her older brother in obtaining a scholarship to study music herself in the heart of Greenwich Village. Little did she know how far-reaching this endeavor would become, shaping the course of her life and career in a multitude of ways. "Music school had a big influence on me," she noted in a 1976 oral history recorded at MIT, her longtime academic home. "As a matter of fact, without music school, I never would be where I am today. Not in any way." A Hard Knock Life. Millie's admittance to the Greenwich House Music School coincided with her introduction to the neighborhood she would call home for nearly 20 years. Today, all that remains of her former walk-up at 1631 Washington Avenue in the Bronx is a nondescript parking lot. On a given day, you might find it 3 blocks south of the teeming Cross Bronx Expressway on the northwest corner of East 172nd Street, littered with trailers, a smattering of parked cars, and piles of empty shipping pallets. The street outside is lined with New York City Fire Department ambulances, standing at attention, while a medical services station and a recently modernized firehouse sit adjacent to the lot. Across the street sits an immense, and immensely drab, industrial park housing a plant run by one of the largest pharmaceutical manufacturers in the world. If you buy prescription or over-the-counter drugs at outlets like CVS or Walmart, there's a decent chance they were made here. Back in the 1930s, however, 1631 Washington Avenue was the site of a cookie-cutter tenement house, home to scores of huddled masses who'd landed in a poverty-stricken neighborhood where crime was rampant. When Millie's family arrived here, The Great Depression was in full effect, but it wasn't the only social force shaping everyday life for New Yorkers. The tail end of Prohibition, the nationwide alcohol ban.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?